Hi, I'm Frances Anderton and this is DNA. On today's show, we're going to hear about a man who didn't court publicity, but he left his mark on many LA landmarks.
Paul Matt was fearless. I believe that his fearlessness inspired Los Angeles to be the birthplace that it is of progressive architecture and design.
Dora Epstein Jones and others recall Paul Matt, the Los Angeles builder who passed on June 30th. First up, though, there's a highly charged competition going on in LA right now, and it's between manufacturers of electric buses. Transit agencies around the country are going electric, and here in LA, Metro hopes to do the same.
The mayor came to our agency back in May and put down a number of challenges to our CEO, and the primary one being to convert the bus to 100% electric by 2030.
That's John Drayton. He's Director of Vehicle Technology at LA County's Metropolitan Transportation Authority. The agency says it will spend around $100 million a year in contracts. So under our noses, a new industry is growing. There are at least 10 companies in the Southland that are making and selling battery electric buses. The biggest is the Chinese-owned company BYD, which has a factory in Lancaster employing over 500 people. There's eBus in Downey, and the newest kid on the block is Proterra in the City of Industry, which likens itself to the Tesla of electric buses. More about that in a moment. So is it possible the capital of car culture is advancing the art of the humble bus, even as Metro currently grapples with a fall in bus ridership? Jeff Joyner is co-chair of the E4 Mobility Alliance. That's an industry council that's working to bring advanced transportation to the Southland.
You know, we're basically becoming the Detroit of electric transportation because we had the supply chain from the aerospace industry. So those same engineers and those same companies that were supplying motors and various capacitors and technologies related to batteries are now supplying this advanced transportation industry. The technology that these companies are coming up with is something that consumers are really going to enjoy.
To get an idea of what's at stake here, consider a contract the Metro Board is expected to approve later this month. It's for 35 buses that are 60 feet long and articulated. That means the long, bendy buses. It's a contract worth millions. These buses will replace those on Metro's Orange and then its Silver Lines. It's the agency's cautious first step toward its 2030 zero-emission bus goal. Metro has to choose between bids from two companies, Canadian New Flyer, which has a service centre in Ontario, California, and BYD. Back to John Drayton at Metro. He's recommending the board select New Flyer.
We have about 5 scoring factors that go into this, and it's basically technical, project management, past experience, and price is obviously a significant factor. Those combination of factors for New Flyer outweighed the proposal we got in from BYD.
We understand that you did purchase some BYD buses back in 2015. 5 is the number we read, and then that those buses were sold back to the company.
Yes, that's correct. They were the first 5 buses that BYD sold in the U.S., and the performance did not meet our contract requirements. And these are areas BYD's since worked through. But primarily it was performance. We couldn't get the bus to go up certain hills here in LA.
That would be fairly scary to be on one of those hills in, say, Echo Park and then find the bus doesn't get up the hill or starts going backwards down the hill.
We actually had that issue in testing, and our staff actually had to back a bus down a hill and into an intersection.
We asked BYD about this, and they said Metro chose to run the buses on steeper roads than had originally been agreed in the contract. The company says that once their buses were reprogrammed, yes, reprogrammed, and the range was adjusted to meet the different conditions, they operated perfectly and were later sold to another transit authority and have been running smoothly ever since. Now, as far as John Drayton is concerned,
I actually think very highly of BYD as a company. Keep in mind, BYD is almost as big as General Motors. It's a huge company. They've got enormous engineering capabilities and resources, and they're a local company. We're very mindful of that.
How much of a factor is the infrastructure and charging?
It's a big factor. We run buses 16, 18, even 24 hours a day at times. If we have a bus that rolls out at 3:30 in the morning, it might not come back till midnight. And it's got to be sustainably operable that whole time. And that means with electric buses, you either have to bring it back in for some form of midday charging typically, or you've got to have charging out in the field, some kind of in-route charging.
Do you have any worries that the technology might not be ready in time?
Yes, I have a lot. Keep in mind, we've got another 170 lines to figure out here. And so I'm optimistic that we're going to see continued improvement in buses and battery technology. We're going to see some reduction in weight. There's a lot of factors we're looking for that we don't see the perfect vehicle out there today. You know, one of our plans is to hold a symposium here maybe this fall and invite all the bus manufacturers and battery manufacturers in and say, this is where you need to be going to allow us to deploy on a broader scale here.
That's John Drayton. He's head of vehicle technology for Metro. A few years ago, Metro fully replaced its diesel buses with compressed natural gas, or CNG, that are nearly as clean as electric buses. It's still buying CNG buses, even as it plans to convert its entire fleet of 2,300 buses to all electric. One of the electric bus companies that hopes to win future contracts with the agency just got to work here in the City of Industry. They've had a soft launch, but will open officially with a big party later this month. Their buses are already on the roads in Seattle, San Antonio, Texas, Stockton, California, Reno, Nevada, and they make up the entire fleet for nearby Foothill Transit in the San Gabriel Valley. The company is called Proterra, and its CEO and president is Ryan Popple. He's the former senior director of finance for Tesla.
I'm hoping it gets to the point where Tesla's called the Proterra of car makers, but we're not quite there yet. So, you know, the biggest difference between Tesla vehicles and other light-duty electric vehicles is Tesla was really the first company that redesigned the entire vehicle. Every element of that vehicle was designed to be an electric vehicle. So that's the same approach we took on the heavy-duty transit vehicle side. The other alternative fuel vehicles we see in this market are, at their core, diesel buses made out of steel. They're heavy, and they've been converted to be electric vehicles or natural gas vehicles, whereas our vehicle is a lightweight carbon fiber composite chassis. It has a much lower center of gravity. The drivetrain is designed for this vehicle, and what it results in is just a very high-performance, long-range vehicle that can outperform fossil fuel vehicles.
What made you decide to open up here? Because you were manufacturing out of state, correct?
We were, and we still are. Importantly, we also decided to put our battery production facility in Northern California. We do need our own battery facility because we take our batteries through a level of testing that exceeds what you'd see in light-duty vehicles. We shoot our battery packs to do ballistic testing. We drop very large pieces of metal on them. We spike them. We shake them. We freeze them. We heat them. We smash them. We do everything to a battery pack that could conceivably happen in a bus or a truck. So we wanted to have full control over our technology.
That's Ryan Popple, CEO of Proterra. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. We spoke with Ryan Popple by phone at the company's headquarters in Burlingame, but we were curious about visiting Proterra's facility here. So we hopped on the eastbound 10, found ourselves in the City of Industry at a nondescript beige building. But step inside and you find yourself in a sleek grey and green reception area facing a giant photo of a Proterra bus, with a destination sign reading, "Proudly built in the USA." Plant manager Paul Mottram greeted us and led us into the facility.
We're trying to create a great environment for our people to work. We're in the lunchroom now, and you can see that it's a nice environment, right? We have every Friday we stop early and get the whole team together in here, and we play games and foosball and giant Jenga, and we have a few beers and, you know, really start to just have some fun around here, you know.
If you come from Liverpool and you're the plant manager, there's got to be some beers.
Absolutely, of course. And since January, we've worked day and night trying to get the facility ready. So now we're in full production mode. So we're in a great spot. We feel like we're just at the brink of something amazing.
At this point, we're joined by TJ Nass, and he works directly with the agencies that buy these buses.
I think if you were to look at the benefits of all electric, you would see that it kind of blows everything else out of the water when you're doing that mile per gallon equivalent comparison.
If the buses are as different from traditional buses as you say, does that mean that the bus drivers need to go through an education to drive these buses?
Definitely. Training is a big part of what we do because you have regenerative braking. You have, in some cases, overhead charging, right? So, which is, you know, autonomous charging that connects via wireless that you have to line the bus up to get that charge.
We talked to a bus rider recently. He's been riding the buses for 50 years. And we talked to him because there's been a reported drop in bus ridership, and we were trying to sort of get at why. And one of his issues was the actual comfort of the seats and the fact that the buses traditionally don't have the creature comforts that a car does, even down to the cup holder. Is that customer experience a big part of the design thinking?
Absolutely. And that has to be, and it really, you said it perfectly, that has to come from the customer.
You know, buses haven't really changed for many years, right? The way they look on the outside and the way they look on the inside. And so, you know, we're bringing new technology with our batteries. So the next step for us probably will be to now start working on changing some of those other paradigms, like, you know, the design outside, the design inside, make it look a little bit more futuristic, you know, and maybe change some of those comforts inside. We're already seeing buses that have Wi-Fi and USB ports and, you know, I was only joking around the other day. It might have, you know, like in an aircraft where you've got a TV in the back of the seat in front of you in the future. Who knows? You know, but the industry is certainly starting to change. And I think, you know, it's about time.
At this point, we leave the break room and walk into a massive cavernous room. This is where the buses are assembled.
Well, we'll walk down to the start of the line, first of all, and then we'll, if you like, we can, we'll just walk the whole assembly line and we'll show you what's going on. Let's go look at the battery, shall we?
That's one battery.
This is one battery. And every bus that we make here in this in the LA facility has four of those.
And that would be what, something like 2 or 3 feet by about 9 or 10 feet or something?
Yes.
And what's inside? This is encased in steel, is it? And then inside is all the...
Yeah, all the cells and all the technology and all the secret sauce. We do have multiple ways to charge the battery. We have the traditional the chargers you can see over there, very similar to the ones that are in the parking lot for our employees to charge their own vehicles. So we have that method. We also have there's also a charge blade on the roof of the vehicle, which basically, as the bus comes into a specific area, maybe in the depot, the bus will automatically dock. And then, you know, a big charging umbrella will position itself over the top of the bus, and then it will charge very, very quickly.
We move on to the new buses that are in varying stages of assembly. Unlike traditional buses that are made of steel, these gleaming white shells are made of a composite of fiberglass and carbon fiber. Each stage of the bus assembly line adds a few more elements, such as cables, seats and windows.
So now you can see we're in now in station two, and station two is where we start to put a lot of the electrical infrastructure in underneath the body. So now you can see, you know, we've got the floor has started to go in. We now have a lot of the cabling, the high voltage cabling, you know, at least routed in the right place. We started to put all the interior lights in. We've got the wall panels in. We've got the floor brackets in for the seats.
So far, only one bus has been fully built at this Proterra facility, but they're preparing to ramp up operations quickly.
I'm going to be building 31 buses here in 2017. I already have close to 200 buses scheduled for 2018. You know, we're looking at doubling production, you know, every year.
As we head out the door, our guides, Customer Program Manager TJ Nass and Plant Manager Paul Mottram, walk us by a wall of patterns. They bear the names of Proterra staffers who've developed innovations in battery electric bus technology.
So we're pretty proud of, you know, all of our patents, or in England we say patents. I get corrected on that one all the time.
It's evidence of the startup feel to this company and the spirit of invention that currently charges this burgeoning industry. Let's go back to the company's CEO, Ryan Popple.
You know, one of the reasons why we're dedicated to this is we want people to care as much about buses and trucks and school buses and all of these utilitarian vehicles that we depend on that aren't necessarily as sexy as cars. So, you know, that's the only reason I joke around about Proterra and Tesla. I do think, though, 20 years from now, buses may matter more than cars. I mean, I think especially as you move into an era with autonomous vehicles, an autonomous vehicle, a ride-sharing vehicle, is more of a bus than it is a car. You know, it is kind of silly that we're trying to repurpose Honda Civics and Toyota Priuses to be taxis when I think the future of urban mobility is something that looks a lot more like maybe a little bit smaller of a bus, but it's going to be an electric vehicle. It's going to be autonomous. It's going to be really cheap and it's going to be clean. We want the humble transit bus to get its due attention.
But for electric buses to succeed, they, like electric cars, have to be supported by the infrastructure, or what Ashley Han calls the complete life cycle. She is strategic advisor for LA Co-Motion. That's an event coming to LA in the fall that's going to demonstrate future modes of transportation.
It's how the fuel itself is generated. So thinking about the grid and grid modernization. So what is the source of our electricity, as well as how you actually build the infrastructure to support fleet electrification. So charging infrastructure, but also things like solar roadways, for example, is a technology that is being tested that I think has a lot of potential here in California.
And a solar roadway would be a roadway that has photovoltaics built into the road surface. Is that right?
Absolutely.
So interesting. Now, these kind of advances involve R&D. How does that stand to be affected by this federal withdrawal from supporting sort of the clean industries?
You know, I think one of the things that we've seen across many cities that I've worked with is that there is an increasing understanding that we can no longer rely on the federal government for this type of investment, which I think is a real shame. There's a huge order of magnitude and efficiency that comes when something is funded at the federal level in terms of this type of research, because you're not trying to replicate research in every single market. We do have incredible strength in terms of the university network and R&D capabilities within the state of California that I think is very promising. But the absence of that federal support and some of the standardization of the approaches that we could take through that type of funding is really going to be lost. And I think that's making it difficult for cities to make investments that they need to make today in things like cleaning up their grid, making sure that they have clean energy going on to the grid, but also thinking about how they build the infrastructure to support the fleet electrification.
So does that mean the private sector in California has to step up a bit more? I mean, what happens next?
I think it's a combination, yes, of the private sector taking more of a risk in making these types of investments in research and development. But I also think that on the public sector side, there needs to be a different approach to thinking about how to address some of these regional and city issues. So really thinking about how do we open up and create a platform for innovation to allow for these new technologies to be tested in the real world.
That's Ashley Han. She's strategic advisor to LA Co-Motion, an urban mobility expo and festival that's coming to LA's Arts District this November. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Now, it's one thing to design a building. It's quite another thing to build it. After this break, we're going to pay tribute to the late Paul Matt. He was the founder of a construction company that figured out how to build many Southern California landmarks.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. You may have visited the Salk Institute in La Jolla, designed by the great American architect Louis Kahn. The serene building made of bare burnished concrete was meant to attract top scientists with its beauty. Or how about the Broad Museum on Grand Avenue in Los Angeles with its decoratively perforated concrete skin? Those buildings seem so permanent and effortless, it's hard to remember that great struggles went into their construction. And at the heart of those struggles was the builder Paul Matt and his company Matt Construction. Paul Matt died on June 30th at age 85, so we thought we'd take a moment to recollect a person who never sought publicity for the high-profile buildings that he helped make possible. Let's start with Dora Epstein-Jones. She's executive director of A+D Museum now and a former warehouse in the Arts District. Matt Construction helped with the retrofit and has supported the Grassroots Museum over the years.
Paul Matt was not your typical builder contractor. The builder contractor relationship typically is one that is thought of as a kind of an obstacle to design, something that has to be moved past or moved over or resolved or negotiated. With Paul Matt, that was not the case at all. One of his first major jobs was working for Louis Kahn in the Salk Institute. And in the Salk Institute, the budget fell out of that project, and really it was Paul Matt who stepped up and said, hey, there's a way to do the formwork and the concrete for this building that will help it meet its budget and be built to the really rigorous specifications of Louis Kahn. He approached building as a kind of collaborative set of problems and challenges between the architect, the builder, the environmental engineer, everybody who's involved in the life cycle of a building, and that these problems and challenges in turn can inspire innovation. And Paul Matt was fearless. He was fearless when it came to innovation in these buildings. And so whether that was the new materials and assemblies that characterize now Los Angeles architecture, or when we look at signature architecture in Los Angeles, I believe that his fearlessness inspired Los Angeles to be the birthplace that it is of progressive architecture and design.
That was Dora Epstein-Jones. Paul Matt started his career working as a welder on the Dallas Dam in Oregon after serving in the U.S. Air Force. Then he became a surveyor, and in 1962 he was promoted to job superintendent on the Salk Institute for Biological Studies. The project architect was Moshe Safdie. The Israeli-Canadian architect later designed the Skirball Cultural Center in Los Angeles, which he worked on with Paul Matt. And that's because, in his view, only Paul was capable of achieving the quality of concrete construction that he wanted.
Concrete is a very temperamental material. And concrete is obviously cement mixed with sand and water, but it's as good as the formwork. And the formwork, which is what you pour it into, can be made of different materials. It can be made of plywood. It can be made of steel. There's many ways of making the formwork, but the craftsmanship of the formwork, the surface, the kind of oil you use to keep the concrete from sticking to it, all matter. And when you bring two pieces of plywood together, if it's not sealed perfectly, if it leaks, then the concrete comes out totally blemished and full of holes. Then you got to get the right concrete mix. It can't be too soft, it can't be too hard, you want a consistent color, it's affected by the weather. It really is like, I guess I'd make the analogy to a very complex dish where it takes many, many ingredients and tricks to get the right results, you know? And with Paul, the way we achieve that is you can't just go and do it, no matter how much experience you have. So each time we need to go through building a mock-up and say, no, no, that's not good enough. What did we do wrong? And for Skirball, we did about five mock-ups on the first phase before we reached the procedure that gave us the result. And he patiently built one after the other, and we would analyze it and discuss it. And So he was a builder at heart.
As in, he loved to make something well.
He loved building as a craft and had the pride of craftsmanship, which without it, there's no great architecture.
That was Moshe Safdie. Melody Kanchat is executive director of the Getty Leadership Council at Claremont Graduate University. She was previously president and COO at LACMA and worked directly with Paul Matt on the construction of several projects there, as well as later the Peterson Automotive Museum. She says Matt was responsible for LA's cultural infrastructure.
If you look at some of the projects that the company that Paul founded, Matt Construction, has been involved with in Los Angeles, you honestly see a group of projects that span the entire county, in fact, the entire Southern California region, in the museum and cultural sector. And it's incredible to think of one company being that involved in such important projects.
Why was it that cultural institutions would choose Matt Construction to build their buildings?
I think it begins at one of Paul's earliest experiences in construction in working with Louis Kahn at the Salk Institute. And I think, he would often talk about understanding that concrete became an artistic medium. So here was a man that I think really became an artist. And he understood that as well as understood the importance of the institutions and the missions that they were trying to fulfill in the community where he lived.
Mm-hmm. Can you recall any kind of real knotty building problem that you...
That's all I can recall.
I guess I should have asked the reverse question, which was there ever a building where there was no knotty building problem? No, tell us a knotty building problem that Paul really helped sort of figure out in a really interesting way.
Specifically, I'd say that in the case of the Peterson Automotive Museum, where an entire skin was removed and then replaced with a much more undulating skin, let's say, Paul worked so hard to bring the right engineers, the right fabricators, the right team together that could understand what the structure could hold in a way that would still make it feel light and airy. He was always able to work a group that he was involved with to bring in a solution that would be the thinnest and the most lovely and airy and bright solution to any structural or construction problem. I'm not being as specific, maybe because I've washed all the bad memories away. I just know they were naughty problems, and there were always plenty of them. But when you're working with somebody that has that, honestly, aura of integrity, like Paul had, he brought a calm and a peace and a willingness to really call in favors to make a cultural organization's project a reality. And he was my knight in shining armor when I was working with him, and I'm sure that many people in Los Angeles felt the same way.
There was Melody Kanchat, and before her Moshe Safdie, and at top Dora Epstein-Jones, remembering Paul Matt, the founder and later the chairman of the board of Matt Construction. He passed away on June 30th at the age of 85. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Thank you very much for listening.